music you might know, or at least music by someone you would know of, and music by someone you very probably don't know, you might have heard of, but very soon I'm sure you will be knowing, well, you'll be knowing him here, on our program, Critical Thinking. I'm your host and producer, Andrew Pattner, but you're going to be knowing him because he's taking off everywhere. He is Nico Muhly, N-I-C-O-M-U-H-L-Y. He has one of the most mind-bogglingly amazing websites, which you can find at our website, wfmt.com/critical thinking, wfmt.com/critical thinking. He's a genius. He knows everything. He does everything. And he's only, I think, 26 years old at this point. He'll be in Chicago this Thursday at the Lakeshore Theater, Broadway just below Belmont, in the Lakeview neighborhood on the north side of the city. This Thursday, August 28th, Nico Muhly, Dove Man, and Sam Amadon. You got me as to who all these people are. It's in support of Nico's new CD, Mother Tongue, One Word, on the Bedroom Community label. More on all of that as we talk with Nico. We had a chance to talk with him, around Halloween. He was in town for his debut on the Music Now series, a work that was done Step Time out at the Harris Theater as a part of Music Now. That marked Nico's belated Chicago debut, since he's had works done in New York and on the West Coast. He records in Iceland. He's probably been on just about every other continent. We lured him to a weird and insecure underground location at Orchestra Hall Symphony Center. So the sound is sometimes a bit strange in this recording. It's something we've taken care of, but we took care of it after the interview with Nico. So we take you now to that basement, uncarpeted room for conversation and more music from and with Nico Muhly. Tell us about what you played for us and why you picked those two things.
I picked first one of my favorite pieces by William Byrd, which is called Bow Thine Ear. It's an English language adaptation of a Latin motet, and it was one of the first pieces that I sang when I was a chorister when I was 11 years old. And for whatever reason, it's the thing that I return to the most, and I think about it probably every day when I think about
this piece,
that specific anthem.
Wow.
And strangely, that specific recording was very important to me. It was the Cambridge Singers with John Rutter conducting. Just for some reason,
I don't think that's strange at all. Don't you think that the recording that we first get to know is a recording that sticks with us?
Well, in this case, it was. I knew it first just by singing
right.
It, and then eventually I acquired many recordings. But this one for me, even though it's women singing the top lines and not boys, it retains that quality of something that is always immediate and kind of like urgent to me. So I played that because I love it. And then I played a piece of mine called Clear Music, which is a cello and harp and celeste piece, which borrows a lot from sort of Renaissance lines and is more influenced by John Taverner, the dead Taverner, not the alive Taverner, but it bears traces of basically that whole period of my life when I was singing a lot and thinking a lot about those extended lines. That I wrote for a friend of mine, a cellist at Juilliard called Wendy, who asked me for a piece. She just said a chamber piece, didn't specify. And I was thinking about, I guess she had won the concerto competition. And so she was first of all playing on a Strad, and second of all playing the Elgar concerto. And
hey.
I thought, all right, great. So she has that high note. So maybe we'll write a piece about all about the high register of that beautiful instrument. And I was thinking about this Taverner motet and how much I missed singing it and was thinking about harp and celeste as a really good combination to back up this sort of tendril of of vocal instead of like a invisible scaffold underneath the cello.
Right. And how do you go about, do you start notating? Do you sit down at a piano? Do you sit at your computer?
Then it was different than now. I mean, one of the things that school was really good at for me was I mean, and specifically my teachers, which were Christopher Ress and John Corigliano, and sort of forcing me to think about structure in a literature.
For those of you who are listening on 33 rather than 45, Nico just said Christopher Ross and John Corigliano.
Yes,
please
okay.
Continue.
is forcing me to think about structure in an actual way, as opposed to letting structure be the accident that happens at the end. Mm-hmm. So then my solution was to kind of map out a whole bunch of ideas, each of which was probably, 2 minutes-ish long, and then sequence them in a satisfying fashion, which is not necessarily a great way to compose.
No, but it can work for a few pieces. And
yeah,
for you at that time.
But now I'm much more disciplined. Mm-hmm.
And how do you work now? At a piano, at a keyboard?
Now I work on paper. Almost exclusively on paper. I don't play anything until the very last stages. Because I actually, when I first moved to New York, I lived at Columbia, and there were no pianos that I could have access to. So I had to very quickly train myself to just keep everything in the ear.
As somebody said to me recently about the conductor who's about your same age, Gustavo Dudamel, don't think of him as a 25-year-old conductor. Think of him as somebody who's been conducting for 13 years. And I don't think we should think of you as a 25-year-old composer. First of all, it's a silly kind
of thing. I'm 26, actually.
And you're now 26, as is Gustavo.
As is Gustavo, exactly.
You guys are moving on up.
Yeah, exactly. We're just ancient.
Right? But it takes away from what it is that you do, and it also makes it sound as if you're trained seals or dogs walking on your hind legs. But you also have been doing your thing pretty much full time for a long time in your
life. For a while, yeah. Although I will say that I started very late as a musician. Like I started singing when I was maybe 10 or 11, and then I started playing piano just before that. When I turned up at conservatory, there was this sense that I had started incredibly late, especially for composers. I mean, most people had sort of started in utero, you know.
But you were doing serious composition, serious enough that your parents put you on an interstate bus when you were 14 to go take lessons.
That's true. Yeah, I started with David Rakowski.
Crossing straight lines to commit modern music.
Yeah.
It could be a federal offense or
exactly.
Something. But where were you choristering?
I was a chorister in Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm.
And was it because you said, "Mama, I want to sing"? Or?
No, it was just a sort of happenstance. As is the case in a lot of things in my life, it was sort of an accident. And I had a friend from school who was doing it, and he thought for some reason that I would enjoy it. Because I said that I liked piano. He's like, "Oh, if you like music, you should join this choir. It's super fun. Mm-hmm. It's random. It's downtown." And what was interesting about it was that it actually wasn't, I mean, fun is not the word that I would use to describe it. It was very professional and kind of intense. And it was very hard work. And it felt very serious to me, actually. I mean, there was fun contained in it. But the overall emotion was serious.
But that
serious.
Sounds like it was a good preparation for the world and the kind of work that you were going to be doing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because you want to have fun and you want to do things that make people enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
But it does take discipline and you do have to learn the various work habits of other people.
Exactly.
And that sort of thing.
And also, one thing that I, in retrospect, of course, at the time I didn't appreciate this, but being in a choir and making music for liturgical context is so great because it's music for use. It's music that has to get used. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work.
Right.
So there's a way in which, you know, in the world of composition, you can kind of get away with writing music that doesn't work in that sense, and it's somehow okay.
Right.
But I feel like because I was trained in that system, I always avoid things that don't go, things that wouldn't make sense.
It sounds as if by having that background and that training, and taking it as training, some people might not realize until years later when they're a successful business person or an actor or some other field that, I was trained in these things. But since you were also taking it as training, you kind of found a way maybe to, it's not quite a Gordian knot, it's more of like a really bad expressway cloverleaf or something.
What's that thing you guys have here, the circle or whatever? I drove through it today and I was like, oh, it's where all the highways.
Right. Well, it's a bowl of spaghetti of some kind. I don't know. There might be a traffic circle or a highway circle, but that's exactly what I'm frantically and unsuccessfully trying to get at here, which is this quote-unquote debate or division of, you know, is music something that's for use? Is music something that an audience should immediately grab a hold of? Is the composer an isolate? Is that a good thing that he should be isolated? And this is a debate we talk about a lot here, and it's something that the person that is why I know you, Alex Ross, has written an entire book about, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. But it sounds as if you sort of have found a way accidentally and purposefully to work your way through all of that.
Yeah, without having to think about it too much.
Well, I'm sure you do think about it, but right, but you didn't have to.
I sort of don't think about it. I mean, I think about it only peripherally. Like, I try not to worry too much about it. I think it feels like I arrived at a good place vis-a-vis it, mm-hmm. Kind of naturally. And
what about where you arrived at being born in 81?
In 81, yeah.
In terms of staking out a claim for, you know, what is the term that you use? With classical music is this funny word that we use, which even didn't make sense applied to Romantic or Baroque music. New music, every music is new.
Right.
But this issue of writing stuff that is not only for pop chart consumption.
Right.
How did you fit that out?
Worried about it, really. I mean, I think generationally, when I was born, was really great. Because I think it was after the sort of embers had cooled of the big ideological battles of the 20th century. And I think people caught making ideological statements after 1981, let's just say, because it's a convenient year for me. You realize that they're actually fanning it a little bit more than they are. You know what I mean? So I feel like I grew up in this atmosphere of, you know, with my parents, who neither of whom was specifically musical, but they had really wide tastes and the kind of tastes that a sort of eclecticism that is not self-conscious. It's just we happen to like this Takamitsu, so we bought it because we heard it on NPR. And then also there's this, you know, random Côte d'Ivoire singer, and, you know, it all kind of works together.
They were human iPods avant la lettre.
Yeah, I mean, but no one was making a big deal of this sort of self-congratulatory, like, hybridity. That wasn't happening, nor was it, you know, there is serious music, and there is notated music, and then there is notated music. You know, it never came up. So for me, it was, I lived a very sheltered life until I turned up in New York when I was 18, and then all of a sudden I realized, if you want to be crazy, everything can be part of these ideological.
But if you don't want to be crazy, you did find a way to just keep going.
You just put your fingers in your nose and say la 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 la. It's totally fine. I mean, you occasionally find, I mean, those battles are sort of like, if you like forget to get in the carpool lane or something, you end up in traffic and you're like, got in the carpool lane. But it's, you know, at a certain point, it seemed, when I turned up in New York, it seemed like you can very easily fall into wanting to talk about style as a function of ideology, or wanting to talk about style as like something that you have a choice in the matter, or not. And if you just ignore it, you have more hours in the day to write music.
And obviously, these are things that we can never know all of the answers to, why a single person has the psychology that he does. But somehow, by having a good attitude and having had these eclectic parents who also were in the arts, even if they weren't musicians, and just having your head on your shoulders, I guess, and some talent too, you just kept persevering.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a nice other version of the narrative. Arrived in New York when they were 18 and got caught up in things. So, and you were at Columbia and at Juilliard. Were you like shuttling or?
Well, they're not that far away. So, right. But basically, the situation is that the way that the program that I did was structured, it's 5 years, and you have 3 years full-time at Columbia, 2 years full-time at Juilliard. At the end, you get a bachelor's from Columbia, a master's from Juilliard. For composers, it's actually not that time-consuming, because what you have to do is take lessons and do occasional kind of, you know, things that all the composers have to do, like go to lectures and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in terms of physical hours I had to spend at Juilliard, it was just a couple a week. Obviously, you're writing a lot and preparing and stuff, but it didn't get crazy until my fourth year, which was technically my senior year at Columbia, and my first year master's at Juilliard, which had to be performed simultaneously. That was kind of nuts.
And were you writing for your teachers? Were you writing for yourself? Were you writing for friends who were helping you perform your
writing
works?
For mainly friends, yeah. That was my scheme. I mean, there are many ways to get your music performed, a lot of which are by winning these kind of this sort of internal to the school competition things, or there's a lot of ways. But I sort of almost exclusively opted to just be friends with people and we just decide that we would do something together, and then I'd write it.
You took the kind of accidental/human route.
Eventually, I realized, you know, that works to a certain extent up to like six or seven people, and then it gets too complicated for you to do yourself, and you need sort of administrative heavy hand.
A Long Line, Lisa Liu on violin, Electronics and Composition by Nico Muhly, our guest today. Nico Muhly, I should say, is spelled N-I-C-O-M-U-H-L-Y. We were talking with Nico when he was in town on the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Day, we have learned recently from Lady Schulte, we've been reminded, for a world premiere of a CSO Music Now commission. Tell us about how Step Team came about.
They asked about a piece that I'd written a couple years ago called By All Means, mm-hmm. which is a quote-unquote response to Webern's Opus 24. Mm-hmm. And
give us a nutshell of Opus 24 and what you mean by a response to it.
Opus 24 is actually one of my favorite Webern pieces because it's one of those pieces where the way that the row works and the way that he introduces it outlined for me immediately when I heard it. I thought about Orlando Gibbons, mm-hmm. and I thought about these ways of cadencing in the Renaissance where you have both the major and the minor third sounding simultaneously, so the Webern is and so you have this B flat and this B natural,
which are not notes that are normally put together.
Yeah. Where you have this noodly little thing.
Right.
Things like that, where the major and the minor are represented at the same time. And I think, you know, that this kind of interval is very beloved of the sort of second Viennese school because it's a sort of obvious dissonance. But for me, it was an obvious dissonance that related to achieving a very fundamental consonance. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, this is a fun game. And it was sort of like a word game, and I set out to write this piece that, in any event, it was, I think, for me, a pretty successful piece of music. And when the people at the Chicago Symphony were talking about programming it, they said, actually, you know, we like it, except it's 9 minutes long, and we were sort of hoping for something more in the sort of 15 to 18 minute
thing. They didn't tell you about this in conservatory, did they? That music is sold by string length
and weight.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
No, it's fine. Whatever. I mean, you know, it should be. I mean, I think that's good. Again, because, you know, when you think about religious music, you can't have, you know, you can't have a 30-minute thing if you have 10 people that right. need to go take communion, nor can you have some little miniature, some Kurtag, you know, thing if you have everyone needing. Anyway, so basically they thought that it would be maybe wiser to commission a new thing, mm-hmm. which I was more excited about too, because, you know, everything is specific.
Right.
And I thought it would be great to really take advantage of specifically the brass section here.
For some reason, you'd heard about the CSO brass.
Yeah. Well, I know they come. I mean, they come to New York on tour, and, you know, whatever. They
are known for making an impression.
They're known for making an impression, exactly. And in particular, low brass.
Right.
For some reason, I've always shied away from trumpets. I don't think I understand them yet.
But that's also a good observation. Yet, you know,
yeah.
You may very well and probably will understand them. But why feel a need to write for every instrument right now? Why
yeah.
not work with the ones that are speaking to you that you think you've been working your way around?
I've just been on this big trombone kick, and I wrote a big piece for multiple trombones that I recorded in Iceland this summer, and then in this ballet that I just wrote, the second movement is you know, kind of a 6 minute trombone solo, and then.
This was a piece you did for
American Ballet Theater,
and Benjamin Bupied, the
exactly.
young dancer choreographer.
Exactly, and so I've been thinking about the trombone as a kind of way of achieving lyrical content, mm-hmm. And I was thinking about these Bruckner motets that have choir and trombone,
right.
and I was thinking also about sort of Chicago's history of the kind of 20th century music that mm-hmm. they like to do here, and I was kind of reading up, and I read some interview with Milton Babbitt in which he said that the only stepwise motion in 12-tone music is the half step. I thought, well, that's an interesting place to start. And I was also thinking about stepping, which is this form of dance, I guess. There was a step team that was, I guess, they practiced very close to my middle school in Providence, Rhode Island, and I remember being completely enchanted by it. And now
stepping, it's got different forms, but it's been a dance popular, a kind of social dancing popular in black community,
yep.
originally with people who'd now be in their 60s, but it's then got picked up again by STEP teams at historically black colleges and the fraternities
and fraternities. And it's always to me been incredibly exciting, especially because basically the rule seems to be, you know, there are exceptions where you can do it to pre-recorded music, but everything comes from the body. Mm-hmm. And there's this intense sort of rhythmic play, but there's a sense that, you know, the feet have their own internal rhythm and the hands have their own rhythm. And then there's, you know, rhythms that are achieved between them. And then there's ways for people to have solos.
Essentially, someone who is as language-oriented and as language-driven as you are also can find, and you do find, such inspiration in something that's physical and nonverbal.
This is new for me. This is actually sort of since I started working with dance.
You're taking a half step.
Yeah, a baby step. That's the next piece. So the piece essentially is I transcribed a very large number of step routines that I saw on YouTube, and I wrote down all the rhythms, and then I sort of wrote a set of rules for how I would divide them up, and so I thought that, you know, there would be certain rhythms that I would assign between the strings, and certain rhythms that I would assign between the winds, and eventually this was a little bit too precious, this method, so I just listened to them all for like 3 days straight and then said, all right, done with it. I'm just going to write this piece.
But so that's a good exercise, isn't it? To give yourself rules and mm-hmm. to make yourself go through things. I mean, sometimes when you're learning a piece as a performer, you just keep doing it by the book, and then though you just throw
then
the
you
book away.
Then you forget it, yeah.
You forget it and start and do it.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, sometimes it's great to have pieces that follow the rule. Like this, for instance, this ballet, which is essentially a 30-minute passacaglia.
Which is called?
It's called From Here On Out, and it's just a passacaglia, plain and simple. I mean, and that has its own set of rules.
So what? There's a 1 minute theme and then
a 1 minute theme and
29 iterations mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah, with a little break. Anyway, so step team has this sort of rhythmic element, and then I also decided that I would harmonically try to have it always feel very much in flux and avoid the sort of cyclical hypnotic repetitions that I normally use. Mm-hmm. And so it moves around a lot. It shifts a lot. And there are moments of controlled improvisation where everyone is playing a rhythm and then certain people are asked to speed up uh-huh. out of sync with everyone else and other people are asked to slow down. So it creates this exciting friction.
You have a day job, which pays your health insurance,
exactly.
But also probably comes in handy for other things. Why don't you tell us what that is?
It's a great day job because it doesn't fit any of the definitions of a day job. It's a sort of theoretical day job, which is that I've been working as a sort of editor and or MIDI sequencer for Philip Glass for many, many years. And what it is that that when he writes things longhand, for instance, a film score, I play it into the computer and supervise the process by which that music is synchronized to the film.
Do you feel ever that you have become an arpeggio, or?
I occasionally reach my arpeggio limits.
Okay.
And there's a complicated set of rules for how many arpeggios in a day, and then you know, then I have to get a cup of coffee or like an ice cream or something.
But I would imagine that in addition to the connection and exposure to whether one is a huge fan or not of his music, I've been a very big fan over the years, but we all come and go, I think, with everybody at Philip Glass as well. But he's a remarkably generous in the classic sense. I mean, he gives, not just opportunities, but
he's an interesting example in terms of even classical musicians, because I think I cannot imagine, because he self-publishes, mm-hmm. and so he owns a publishing company that has employees.
Right.
And he owns a recording studio, which itself has employees. And I can't think of that many classical musicians who directly employ and provide livelihood for that many other people.
Right.
Which, you know, in and of itself is totally admirable. And I think, you know, to do that and still write as much as he does, I mean, I think it's really amazing.
And because of all these other employees, they're also people who have other interests. And you meet people who are
right.
friends, collaborators.
There's a sense that it is a real family. It's a great feeling.
And was it through that group that you made a connection with somebody who lets you use a studio in Iceland?
I started going to Iceland through the singer and composer Björk, and I worked with her actually in New York, and then through her I met this man who was doing programming for her called Valgeir, and he and I sort of.
But how did you first meet Björk, or Björk, as people would know?
Sort of through people in New York. Okay. Through I guess it was just sort of.
And then did she hear your music? I mean, a lot of people would like to meet her and go to Iceland.
Essentially, what happened was that she asked me to play piano for this one song, mm-hmm. and I it was a really complicated piano part, and I figured out how to do it, and then I did a couple other little things.
She's of course a remarkable example of somebody who's in the quote unquote popular right. world, but whose music is informed by everything. She's yeah. so creative.
Yeah, well, it's just her music has a wide. I mean, in as much as I feel very liberated by my, you know, generation or whatever, I think she even more so because, you know, from the pop music side, there's just more. You have a bigger embrace. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that you can do whatever you want, but you have the resources and the structure to really take the time and think about sound and. You know, you're not working on commission, so there's no real deadlines except for the ones, you know, if you're beholden to a giant record company, then maybe, but...
She's also both personally enough liberated and artistically enough and financially enough. She can do an album and she doesn't care if that album is going to be the number one album yeah. of that year, and then she might do an album that's more poppy.
Conversely, I think it's nice to sell albums, you know, I mean, but I think part of it is that you can challenge people by having a fan base. I mean, it just doesn't work that way in classical music, right. where you have a fan base whom you can, I mean, it's almost in pop music, it's that sort of made up thing that people thought that conductors should do, which is that, you know, subscribers to the symphony will be educated by the Promethean efforts of the conductor. You know, everyone thought in the 80s and 90s that was going to be the trick. And, you know, obviously that didn't really work right, so much. Right. But in a sense, with pop music, that does happen because people will buy an album and an album has, you know, 13 things on it, and you'll listen to it because you're a fan, and on that there'll be more experimental things that you can then be led to by
right.
someone
you
trust.
Somebody like a Björk or a Beck, or Rufus Wainwright, or somebody yeah. who works with a lot of things, and, well, as the Beatles did before, embed so many yeah. other things that people then, hey, who's this poet? I want to read that person.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Or what's swing dancing? I want to do that. I saw it in the Björk video, you know. Or,
yeah. Or right, exactly. And I think, you know, to connect it back to the classical world, like there was this enormous hope that the orchestra would be the institution that would be the sort of the vehicle for intellectual stimulation for the masses, and I think people just sort of resisted that.
Well, one person who's thinking about, as you can hear, all of these questions and also responding musically to them, but responding not angrily and not in a tendentious way, is Niko Muhly, and we're going to be hearing a lot more from him as he's more and more known by more and more orchestras and other commissioning and other pop and other music people. But I know personally, too, FMT Lee, we'd love to have Niko back. We were just kind of squeezed in between rehearsals and performances while he was here.
I will come back anytime.
And we'll have him back. And maybe we should go out with some Björk and some Muhly. Could we do
sure,
that?
Sure, we can.
Niko, thank you so much for coming by and sharing your music and your ideas.
Thank you for having me.
J-O with umlauts R-K, I see who you are, and I think she sees who we are, for sure. Orchestrated by our guest, Niko Muhly. Music, insight, merriment, just a taste of, I think, a quite amazing young fellow. I've known him, I think, since he was a teenager. Maybe he was 20. Niko Muhly. He's going to be in town this Thursday at the Lakeshore Theater in his sort of non-classical guise, along with Dove Man and Sam Amidon and our friend Dan Bora, doing a lot of sound things. This Thursday, August 28th, the Lakeshore Theater on Broadway at Belmont on the southeast corner there, 3200 North and about 600 West in the Lakeview neighborhood on the north side of Chicago at 8 o'clock. You can find and hear more about Nico by going through our website, wfmt.com/criticalthinking, and you can find Nico's website, and we also would encourage you to check out his latest CD, Mother Tongue, One Word, put out on the Bedroom Community label. We'd like to thank Adam Abraham for initially recording this interview under difficult circumstances, and Matt DeStefano, who always does his best to make this program sound as good as it does, even sound better than it is. We want to thank all of you who've been listening to this program, and especially those of you who've been listening via podcast. We recently passed our 15,000th download. But we'd also like to hear from you. Do you listen on the podcast? Do you listen on the radio? Do you like listening? What do you think? Drop us a line. rentap@aol.com. That's Patner spelled backwards. rentap@aol.com. We want, as always, to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity company, as well as other listeners to this program. We'll go out now with a brief excerpt of a little more music by Nico Muhly from the aforementioned Mother Tongue. Wonders, Part 3, A Complaint Against Thomas Wilkes.
Diverse times and very often come so disguised, either from the tavern or alehouse into the alehouse, into the quiet much to be lamented, as much to be lamented. He will.
How do you keep all those lines in your head healthy and lovely?
Cod liver oil. I know, I don't know.